Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Miriam Gerba is a writer and artist. You may remember her true crime memoir, Mean. It was a New York Times editor's choice and made Oprah's best of list. Now Miriam is back with an incredible essay collection called Creep, Accusations and Confessions. Former Beta guest Rachel Kushner says, quote, Gerba is tender but tough, and her book gleams with voluptuous horror, historical rigor, and astonishing psychological depth, unquote. I knew I had to read this book when I noticed that her publisher described it as Miriam Gerba's informal sociology of creeps. I love that description, and maybe that makes me a bit of a creep, but I hope not. So I asked Miriam to join us to talk about her collection and to define creep for us.
Creep is a vast bucket. There are all sorts of figures and phenomena that can be placed in that bucket. I am using it as a shorthand for abusers and oppressors. However, I do think that every human being has creep potential. We all have a little creep sitting inside of us just itching to come out and play. And so part of the project of the book Creep is to invite readers to look inward and to identify that inner creep and take inventory of our own sort of participation in what I call creepdom.
Mm-hmm. And you said that we all have a creep coming out to play, but so that it does mean that it can have kind of a playful side, but it can also have a very negative and dangerous side, can't it?
Absolutely. You know, I would argue that creeps exist along a continuum as well as along a spectrum. And for example, Halloween is just around the corner and we're going to be reveling in sort of joyful creepiness. And as a teenager who was very interested in all things gothic, I was attracted to sort of joyful creepiness. However, much of my book deals with serious creepiness.
Yes, very much so. Yeah. Let's talk about your opening essay, which is called Tell. Can you tell us a bit about Tell?
So the title Tell can be looked at in several ways. We have a narrator and she is telling. So I'm almost positioning the narrator as a tattletale of sorts. She's telling stories she perhaps shouldn't be telling. I'm also invoking a story, a legend that was developed by beat writer William Burroughs that involves the domestic violence killing of his common law wife, Joan Vollmer. So it's an invocation of both of those phenomena.
Mm-hmm. And one of the, you kind of hinted at it there, but I want to ask you more specifically, one of the many things that I find fascinating about your writing is the way that so many of your essays start with these personal anecdotes. And then at some point, your essays shift to explore historical events. It's really intriguing. Why do you choose to structure your essays this way?
I'm very strongly drawn to chronicling in the first person. And so when I have sort of this first person entry point into an essay, I attempt to establish some sort of rapport with my reader, with my audience through a personal anecdote. And when I taught high school, which I did for about 15 years, I often began lessons that way. I often began lessons with a story because a personal story is an excellent way to get people hooked into sort of like a didactic process. It's a way to trick them into learning. What I'll do is I'll take this personal anecdote and then I'll situate it within larger histories to demonstrate how I, as well as my family and other figures who are close to me, are embedded within these larger narratives and histories.
Mm. So the historical event, you don't necessarily know what it's going to be when you start writing the personal anecdote. Would that be fair to say?
Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. For example, in that essay, Tell, where I describe William Burroughs's gender-based violence and also other gender-based violences perpetrated by other figures who are well-known and also lesser-known, you know, I had this idea in mind that I wanted to write about these figures, but I also knew that I couldn't immediately sort of present these figures. I needed to slowly build toward them. And so I decided to pull an anecdote from my own life where I'm also engaged in games that are similar to the games that these creeps are playing.
Mm-hmm, these morbid childhood games. So until you start by describing the morbid childhood games that you played, and then it's only 8 pages later, you're writing about William S. Burroughs and the incident involving his wife, Joan Vollmer, that occurred on September 6, 1951. What happened?
We don't really know what happened. We have Burroughs's word, and we have the word of several witnesses. In the essay Tell, what I attempt to do is recuperate the figure of Vollmer. So often, she is relegated to a footnote in the history of the Beatniks, and I am trying to restore her to the status of main character. Vollmer could hold her own. She was a brilliant person. She was a wit. She was an artist in her own right, who became trapped with an abusive beat figure who claimed that he had been playing a game that was intended to demonstrate his good marksmanship to several men who were witnesses to a violent game. He invited Vollmer to place a glass on her head. He took out a gun. He shot at the glass. He missed the glass and shot his wife in the head. And I think very interestingly is the detail that one of the men present at the shooting was a lover of Burroughs. And men often engage in acts of femicide in order to impress other men. That's a detail that I don't often hear emphasized about that murder.
Yeah, I love what you said earlier about recuperating the person of Joan Vollmer, because that is such a key part. That's what really kind of hit home with me that, yeah, I didn't know all this stuff. And to make matters worse, in my own head, I kind of realized, hey, how come I didn't seek out this information? You've listened to men tell you what Joan felt in the seconds before Burroughs shot her. What have they told you?
I detail an experience that I had with a boyfriend who was older than me when I was in high school. He was of an inappropriate age. And I remember him taking me to his home to watch the film Naked Lunch. And he was so eager to watch this film with me. He insisted that Vollmer had been a very good female partner because she had been invited to perform this dangerous act and she had obeyed. She had trusted her husband enough to engage in this dangerous act with him. And I remember being sort of puzzled by the admiration that my then boyfriend was heaping on Burroughs, because yes, Vollmer seemingly trusted this man to her fatal detriment. And, you know, in retrospect, I now see that I was also being groomed to trust a certain kind of man to my own detriment as well. Because I was 15 years old at that time, and the man who was telling me this was in his mid-20s. Yeah.
As you mentioned, you talk about watching my fellow Canadian David Cronenberg's adaptation of Burroughs' supposedly unfilmable novel, Naked Lunch. And you say that you watched your ex-boyfriend stuff a video into the VCR's rectangular mouth. And I'm wondering, is this a sly reference to Cronenberg's film Videodrome?
It is, yes. So it's a low-key reference to Cronenberg's aesthetics. Those sort of tech aesthetics. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, good. I'm glad I asked that, because I thought that's got to be a reference.
And thanks for catching that.
Oh, sure. Thanks for including it. Thanks for putting it in there to catch, because when I read that phrase, it immediately reminded me of that scene in Videodrome in which the VHS tape is thrust into a slit in the stomach of James Woods' character. So thank you for including that. We can't really talk about Joan Vollmer without talking about the excellent performance of the Australian actress Judy Davis, who plays Joan Vollmer in the film. And you wrote very poetically about her performance. Can you tell us a bit about the role that she plays in Naked Lunch?
Naked Lunch is a sausage fest, right? It's a man-centric film. And I remember thinking that when I watched it, I was all, wow, it's man after man after man, except we are treated to the impeccable performance of Judy Davis, right? And, you know, like I said, I was in my teens when I first saw this film, and I was a closeted bisexual. I remember watching the film and being absolutely seduced by Judy Davis's portrayal of this beat woman. There was something very icy, very chilly, very grotesque, and very naked about Davis, regardless of her being sort of fully dressed, there was just this perversion about her that excited me. And I imagine she cast that same spell on a lot of queer Gen X girls. She sort of became a bit of a muse for us.
Yeah. You've said that it's your gallows humor and insult comedy that allows you to write about trauma. How so?
For a very long time, I did not want to write about trauma that I had experienced personally. For a very long time, I not only avoided it, but I downplayed certain experiences that I had had. In particular, there was an experience that I survived when I was 19 years old. I was sexually assaulted by a stranger who was a serial attacker. And when I was around 30 or in my early 30s, I finally began to acknowledge that what had happened to me at age 19, my having survived that attack, had had a profound imprint on the trajectory that my life had taken. And I decided to sort of buckle down and really look into sort of the abyss, right? And I found the abyss staring back at me. And I really wanted to explore what I had survived through prose. And so I began to read other survivor narratives. And while accessing those was heartening, it was heartening to see survivor narratives on the page, I was bothered by certain storytelling habits that I began to notice. I found people narrating with a humorlessness, with a seriousness, and almost with sort of like a reverential tone. And to me, that seemed grotesque. Like, how can we write about one of the most heinous moments of our lives in a sacral tone? To me, it seems that rape and sexual assault are the most vicious, misogynist, abominable, practical jokes that are played on us by patriarchy and misogyny. And so what I began to think was, why not narrate survivorship using grotesque humor as well? Given the fact that I think humor is horror's closest stylistic relative. And so I began narrating sexual assault using humor, and I found that afforded me a certain level of protection.
Mm-hmm. Very well said. Yeah, and you're right. Humor and horror combine so well.
Thank you.
And you do that very effectively, yeah. You worked as a teacher in Long Beach for a while, and you've said that when you're writing, you always have your former students in mind. If you don't mind my asking, what kinds of thoughts are going through your mind about your students when you're writing?
So as far as students go, what I tend to do is keep them in mind as an audience so that I can sort of shape whatever message I have and tailor it to them. And what that forces me to do is it forces me to consider a really broad audience. It forces me to consider an audience that's as young as a teenager. And then when I also consider sort of my elders, I also have to consider audience members who might be in their 70s or 80s and 90s. So it forces me to really craft a message that doesn't alienate people.
So being a school teacher was a big help in being a writer. Would that be fair to say?
Yes. Yeah. In many ways, I owe my voice to my students.
You come from a family of storytellers. What does your family think of Creep?
I invited them to participate in the writing of Creep. So in a sense, the book was co-written by several family members. There's an essay titled Locas, which is the only essay in the collection that was commissioned by a family member. So my cousin Desiree came to me and essentially gave me instructions, and I'm paraphrasing what she said, but in a nutshell, what she said is that she exists as a criminalized Latina in the criminal legal archives of the United States of America. She spent 15 years total in various California jails and prisons, and crime reporters have also written about her. And she has long been bothered by this particular legacy. And what bothers her most is that she exists as this criminalized individual, but there's no story explaining how it is that she was transformed into a female gangster. And so she entrusted me with the telling of her creation, her birth as a female gangster. Female gangsters are made. They don't come out of the womb throwing gang signs. And so my cousin and I, when we were about 13 years old, we actually created our own gang. It was a two-girl gang called Pocas Pero Locas, which means the few but insane. And so we formed this two-girl gang, and my cousin and I took very different routes in life after that. My cousin became an actual mafiosa, and I became a teacher and a writer. And because I've been a witness to my cousin's entire life trajectory, she picked me as the person to tell her story. And because I've never been jumped out of our childhood gang, I couldn't say no. So that's an example of how some of these essays were co-written.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that example. Miriam Gerba, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on Creep, Accusations and Confessions. It's an incredibly haunting and powerful book.
Thank you so much.
Miriam Gerba is the author of Creep, Accusations and Confessions. Find out more about Miriam and what kind of creep you are at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Greg Proops, Reggie Watts, and Miriam Gerba.
What you're gleaning from these interviews is groundbreaking.
Beta is available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Don't forget to offer a rating to share with new alphas. And you can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
Oh, hey, Steve.
Our executive producer, nay, showrunner, is Adam Friedrich.
Hey, Adam!
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
Hey, aren't you Doug Funny from that show, Doug?